It's a challenging parasha, Shmini. I think it's one of the first I ever spoke on in a synagogue. It's difficult. Nadav and Avihu die for very little explicable reason, or if there is a reason, it's somewhat obscure to us. And so we're forced to confront the reality of death and grief and change and transition, which is inherent to life. I think I was talking to Mitch Goldman that every now and again I get in a routine and things go well, and then that lasts about 6 months at the longest. You can be in sort of a routine before something changes. The Mechilta, one of our oldest traditions and collections of midrashim, of rabbinic teaching, teaches the phrase, kol hatchalot kashot, every beginning is difficult. Likewise, every ending, every transition, every liminal point presents us with challenges. Our tradition is not unaware of this difficulty, and many traditions as diverse as India and Italy are aware of it. Shiva, one of the gods in the Indian pantheon, in the Hindi pantheon, is the god of destruction. In the tarot deck out of Italy, the tower card represents the raising of what we knew, the elimination and the process of preparing for new growth. My father, when I was young, taught me about the idea of a climax forest, wherein the trees have grown so dense that there's no room for new growth, and the only thing possible is forest fire, which clears the way for new growth. And if you've ever seen a forest fire, which I recall seeing the outcome of in Montana, I think it was, little sprouts. A couple months and years later, you start to see the sprouts out of the black char, like a phoenix. That's the nature of change and renewal and process and boundary, that we reach inflection points, that we reach moments where we have to make difficult decisions in order to move on, sacrifice, grieve, worry. Yesterday I spoke at the university's annual memorial service. Couldn't have been a more auspicious, I suppose is not the right word, but a more appropriate parasha to speak about memory and memorial and death. There is, says our tradition, something that doesn't die, and they speak about this largely in the case of debt. They say, Ein Sibur Met, community doesn't die. There are those things that come and go and vary and cross no boundary, and on the other side is a different experience, but we, the eternal we, endure. And death and change is something to fear, is something to grieve, is something to grapple with, but is not a moral judgment. One of my favorite teachings in the Talmud is that the rabbis speak of four who died through the counsel of the serpent from Genesis. That it's only sometimes, at least in four cases, but we can certainly think of more, that we die because mortality was visited upon us in the earliest era. I had this thought this week, and I don't have an answer, but it's an interesting thought experiment. If we all lived into the thousands, if our average lifespan was some thousands of years, would we experience the days differently? Do cats and dogs experience days differently, or goldfish for that matter, than we do? But there is none among us, says a Sufi mystic poem, who does not die. No matter how fast, we cannot escape that. So what are our responses to change? How do we respond to difference and decisions that force an inflection point and moments of transition? The first, I think, natural response is to take pause, is to be honestly silent in front of change, at the boundary between two states, literal or figurative. Pause, reflect, notice. If you're at four corners, notice which state is on each corner of you. Take a moment at the top of the Continental Divide before you go back down on your bicycle. That's what we have in this parsha, two great moments of silence, that when Nadav and Avihu die, we again through no clear reason, almost through no fault of their own except in Midrash, Aaron pauses. Aaron is silent. Vayidom Aharon. Same language that will later be used in Ezekiel and Lamentations and to describe Elijah's encounter with God. And later, when Aaron tries to explain himself to Moses, Moses, it said, heard and it seemed good in his eyes, implying he said nothing. Our sages in Pirkei Avot said that Shimon used to say, all my life I grew up among the wise, but I found nothing better for a person than silence. Change comes on us all, whether it's the change of death, a change of employment, a change of social status, a change of physical or biological status, from childbearing to menopause, from parenthood to grandparenthood. Those changes arrive at us, and I think taking stock silently is always a fair experience. And then to do these things with some sort of internal dignity, to face them with equanimity, without too much fear, without distress as possible, or at least not to become agitated. One of Heschel's ancestors, one of the Apta Rebbe's, noticed that the olah, the upright offering, the offering that ascends to the sky, and the chatat, the sin offering, the offering made after a transgression, are offered in the same place. I think the idea he's saying is that since you can't tell whether someone's coming as a transgressor or as a pure person offering a natural sacrifice, it preserves the dignity of the transgressor. That we make change in life with as much kindness to ourselves and to others as possible. That we strive to treat ourselves, to treat those bereaved, to treat ourselves in grief, to treat the deceased, to treat others with dignity. And to not savor transitions too eagerly with avarice or greed or viciousness. That we have to make in life difficult decisions that cross boundaries that lead us from one state to another, from Montana to North Dakota. If you ever cross that boundary, it's an interesting experience because North Dakota is like second-rate Montana. You're in Montana. We were in Montana for about 12 days, probably the most beautiful place in the country outside of parts of Tennessee. And then you cross into North Dakota, which is decidedly not the same. But you don't cross borders. You don't make changes willy-nilly or cruelly. It's always so odd to me that Parshat Shemini deals with the deaths of Aaron's son. This was the first thing I ever preached on about this parsha. And it also includes the laws of Kashrut, which message I think is life happens. Life is difficult. Life comes with pain, shock. And sometimes we need the tether, the foundation of regular experience. That kashrut, the day-to-day lived experience at table, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, is a way to cope with the rapidity of change in life. And so we deal with kashrut in this parasha, and Nachmanides, a French Tosafist, a French pseudo-mystic, let's say, tries to make sense of the birds, of the fowl that we are allowed to eat and those we are not. So among them, you can't eat the eagle. You don't typically eat birds of prey. So he says, we're commanded not to eat those animals possessed of a cruel nature, lest we absorb those qualities to ourselves. You are what you eat was a trope of the ancient world and the medieval world. Approach change with silence, with reserve, with dignity, without cruelty, and walk carefully into it. But it will be necessary in life to make changes. It will be absolutely required to discipline a child, to give a bad grade if you're a professor, to make changes in yourself, to abandon past behaviors or homes that were convenient but too complacent. And as you know, there is, I think, an aphorism, and you don't know this part, but you'll get to what I know. There's an aphorism, I think, in Chinese, something to the effect of, if it moves, you can eat it. Whereas we have almost the opposite. There's almost, if you think about it, almost nothing we can eat. No animals. The long list of forbidden animals far outnumbers the few animals we get to eat. Sheep, goats, chickens. Delicious, though they are. Though I did once like carnitas, which is a wonderful Mexican pork preparation, but long time ago. That's the nature of our lives as Jews, but frankly, as a life of a growing and decent human being, you have to make choices, hard choices to keep what's in and to exclude what's out. And that's one of the first names we hear of God. God is called El Shaddai. I think it's in around Genesis 10. God presents God's self to Abraham as El Shaddai. God, it's traditionally understood to mean a God of a mountain or God of the bosom. But in Talmud, I think they make a much more interesting etymology. El meaning God, and Shaddai, She-Dai. The God who says die, which in Hebrew means enough. The God who caused creation to stop expanding so that it would have fixed boundaries. Not only the nature of Kashrut, the nature of Judaism, but the nature of the divine. So on the one hand, we accept change with benevolence or equanimity. On the other hand, we are forced to enact and effect change internally, externally, professionally, personally, in families, in businesses. So how do we do that? How do we live our godly nature of making boundaries? It's a fact. So one way is to do it rarely. The priest's job, Leviticus, of course, the code of the priest, Torat Kohanim, the Torah of the priest, it's nicknamed by our sages, is to distinguish the sacred from the profane, the tameh from the tahor, which we often translate as pure and impure, but might more readily be described as prepared and unprepared, fitting and unfitting, meaning it can or cannot be used in the sacrificial system. So the Vilna Gaon, it'd be nice to be called a Gaon. I doubt he called himself that because it means a great one or a genius. I doubt he called himself the Vilna Gaon. I think he called himself Yisrael. That was his name. But notes that in these aspects, that in order to be a good teacher, and the priests were understood to have pedagogy, one had to be parsimonious in their use of pure and impure in their definitions, meaning gentle, not overusing one's power. Using and confronting systems only when absolutely necessary and doing one's utmost to please, to strive, to maintain shalom. That's also part of Aaron's nature. On the flip side, not to be falsely modest, not to be inappropriately modest. And my uncle, I think I taught you this, he doesn't say false modesty, he says inappropriate modesty. It's being modest at the wrong time. So later in the parsha, Aaron is afraid. Aaron's seen his sons die and is uncomfortable, either maybe in some sort of passive-aggressive way toward God, or maybe just nervous about his own fragility and mortality, does not approach the sacrificial system. And Moses sort of calls him out because he's being unnecessarily bashful, unnecessarily modest. And Moses said to him, "Why are you ashamed? It's for this that you were chosen. Step up to the plate. You have a role to play in life. It will be difficult. You will have to make hard choices. You will have to endure hard choices. You have to endure pain and suffering at times. Excision, splits, division, loss. And yet you shouldn't shy away from the hard choices. And you shouldn't be afraid to step through the moments of grief, literal and metaphoric." The Sfat Emet, one of the Hasidic masters, says that duty is worth more than intent. He's trying to explain why Nadav and Avihu die. Maybe they wanted to offer a sacrifice, but they weren't intended to, or it wasn't their obligation to. That's the closest and not very good explanation of their death I've heard. A lot of sages think it was they weren't required to bring the sacrifice, and they did it out of a joy, and it's to teach us that God wants things on demand, and not just because it makes you feel good. I don't think that's an easy explanation for why two young men die apropos of nothing, or seemingly. But it's a good lesson in life. Sometimes we do things because we have to, not because we want to. Not because they're easy, but because they're hard. If one reflects back on one's life, and for me it was the Peace Corps, parenthood, a few other experiences, the cross-country bike trip, becoming a rabbi, the hardest things are the ones that have the most value. Your first kiss has a lot of value, and it's pretty easy, but that's the exception to me that proves the rule, right? There are very few things in life that are attained with ease and are really worth much. Sometimes we are commanded and called to do difficult things, and that's the nature of growth and being a decent human being and being a strong Jewish person and growing that neshama, that spirit, that soul. I want to close with a quote that's not Jewish, but I really like. Does anyone know who Becky Hammon is? First female coach in the NBA. She's at the San Antonio Spurs. As many of you might know, I don't know much about sports. That's the extent of my knowledge of her. Great article about her in the New Yorker, and it closed with this. And I want you to think about this as a Jewish maxim as well. The sort of the last third of the article treats whether, as a female coach, she'll be accepted. Will she ever get a top coaching job? How do the players relate to her? How does the press relate to her? And the last thing she's quoted as saying is, "My job is to be the best that I can be. If that changes your mind, then great, but I can't be consumed with how you feel about me." It's really hard. Some people want to please others more than some people. Some people want to please others less, but it's important to every single human being to please other people. And it's not an instinct we have to ruthlessly suppress, but it is one that sometimes goes against our best natures. Sometimes we have to make hard choices. Sometimes we have to endure hard choices. And we have to do that with equanimity and duty. Your job, our job, is to be the best that we can be. And if that changes other people's mind, great, but we can't be consumed with how they feel about us.